KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Welcome to a new year, indeed a new quarter of Hearsay Culture. I'm very pleased to be back here on KZSU's airwaves, as well as doing the podcast. And I'm very excited to start off this quarter with a really fascinating guest, Kristen Lord, who has authored a book entitled The Perils and Promise of Global Transparency, subtitled Why the Information Revolution May Not Lead to Security, Democracy, or Peace. Now, notice what how I've already introduced this topic. Notice the subtitle, Why the Information Revolution May Not Lead to Security, Democracy, or Peace. Longtime listeners of Hearsay Culture will know that while I'm not myopic, I certainly have very strong views with respect to technology and its ability to indeed create, at least, certainly the democracy part. Peace might be more of a stretch. I think security is subject to more debate, but certainly the subtitle, I think, is quite illuminating and kind of drew me to the book initially. Professor Lord, who I will describe her background in more detail in a moment, has written a book which I think to technologists may in large measure be counterintuitive. It's a book that focuses on really a fundamental challenge to what we think of as the benefits of transparency and really calling into question in a very critical and very scholarly way some of the assumptions that we make regarding transparency and its ability to create a more secure world. The focus of the book is heavily in national security, and while it's not a topic that I generally discuss on Hearsay Culture, it's one that's clearly relevant to our larger discussion involving the democratic and democratization aspects of technology that have been a longtime theme on the show. And so I'm excited to have Professor Lord on the show, who's really capable to kind of bring a very different perspective and a perspective of one who focuses heavily in this area, more so than certainly I do and many people in the technology world. Kristen Lord is the Associate Dean for Strategy, Research, and External Relations and Assistant Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at the George Washington University Elliott School of International Affairs. Her background, as you would gather certainly from her affiliation, is in international affairs in particular. She oversees the school's four research centers, graduate admissions, public affairs, and strategic initiatives, and indeed teaches courses in U.S. public diplomacy, the cause of war, and U.S. foreign policy. She also serves as a non-resident fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, where she convenes the Science and Technology Working Group of the U.S. Islamic World Forum, and as the inaugural Science Diplomacy Fellow at the University of Southern California Center for Public Diplomacy. She's also been involved in the Council on Foreign Relations, Special Advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs. Aside from being the author of the book that we're going to be discussing today, she's also the author of the book Power and Conflict in the Age of Transparency, edited with Bernard Feinel. That's a Macmillan publication from 2000, and has also authored a number of book chapters and articles. So we're going to be discussing today on Hearsay Culture really this question of transparency, what we mean by it, what are some of the lessons that we can derive based upon not only what's gone on in the world from a practical perspective, but also based upon a lot of the theoretical discussion that has surrounded the pros and cons of transparency, and in that conversation also get into some of the technology issues as well. So if I've done my job properly, and I hope I have, on the other end of the phone, on the other end of the mic, is Professor Lord. Kristen, are you there?
I am. Thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you so much for being here. And being the kind of show that it is, I first want to say publicly that I thank you for your patience as I have had to reschedule the show several times. I greatly appreciate your flexibility in doing the show, and I'm very happy that we were able to make this work. So thank you so much again for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Let's start off with a question that I ask really all of my guests to set the context. But why did you write the book, and what is your background that brings you to writing this particular work?
Well, you started off by saying you're what I call a technology optimist. And before I started writing this book, I probably described myself as a technology optimist too. I personally have a background in international security. My doctoral dissertation was on the causes of war. And I really thought that this new world that we were entering way back then, where information is more widely available to a broader public, where there's a condition of openness and information flows freely around the world. I really thought that this was going to be a favorable trend, especially for international security. And then I did some research, and then I found out that the world was a lot more complex, and the implications of global transparency were a lot more complex than I previously had appreciated. And the more I read, the more I believed that, but also at the same time, I looked around and I saw no one else making this argument. So I decided that it was my job to try and make people understand the complexity of global transparency. Not that it won't have benefits, because clearly it does, but it's just a much more difficult and complicated and dangerous phenomenon that than even I had appreciated before.
And certainly you've identified me, I think accurately, as an optimist in this area. I'm curious, before I get into the substance of the book and discuss it, over how long did it take for you to put this work together, and I guess at what point in your research did you start questioning the assumption that you came in with?
Well, I think the real origin of the book is actually back in 1993. You mentioned my colleague Bernard Pinnell. He and I were graduate students together a long time ago at Georgetown University, working on a research paper, and in private conversations, we were saying, oh, this new trend that we're seeing, we think it's going to have very positive implications. And it was really together that we started doing research and saying, well, this is a much more complicated phenomenon. So actually, the origins go way back. Mm-hmm. I wrote this book right around 2000, 2001, 2002, and 2003. And then the academic publishing timelines are very long, so you'll see that it's gone through peer review and all those usual processes. And so it's just come out last year in 2006. But a lot of the research was actually done right around the time of 9/11, which made it a very interesting time to be writing.
And clearly, you know, this is a topic that the national security aspects, of course, are coloring not only the policy that we as a nation consider, but also indeed the decisions that are being made by people that are in a position to decide just how much transparency there's going to be. So perhaps a good jumping off point to get into the discussion is really to ask you at a meta level what you mean by the title itself and what you hope to convey.
The title is The Perils and Promise of Global Transparency. And what I'm hoping to convey is exactly that complexity that I mentioned. Global transparency is not a great good that is only going to lead to positive outcomes in the world, but it's also not something that's uniformly dangerous either. I am actually a believer in transparency. I think it's morally right as a policy of governance, but that doesn't mean that all of its implications will have positive effects for people around the world. And so what I was really trying to show in the book are those many facets of global transparency and how it will affect security, how it will affect conflict, how it will affect democracy and U.S. foreign policy in the world.
The context of the book, I think, is one that should be discussed up front. So you mentioned working on this in the wake of September 11th, and I guess to start off really getting into the topic, how does the national security climate as it exists today color the analysis that you're bringing in this particular work?
I feel vindicated, actually, and I think that if I had published the book even earlier, it would have seemed a lot more controversial than it does today. I think in the wake of the Mohammed cartoon crisis, for instance, where we saw some cartoons in Denmark of Betray the Prophet in ways that weren't being flattering, and how quickly that news spread around the world and led to riots and protests around the world, threats against the cartoonists back in Denmark. I think those kinds of events have only shown exactly what I mean, that transparency is not only a positive trend, and it's not only something that spreads harmony and tolerance. It can also spread hate and lies and eliminate disagreements as well as shared values.
I think that's, given that analogy to the Mohammed cartoon situation, I think it's a good time to ask the what would be an obvious good question to start off with, which is what you mean by transparency.
Well, I think that transparency is a condition of openness in which information is widely available to a global public. And I think there are actually several things that have led to this broader availability of information. One of them is the spread of democracy. There are just simply way more democracies in the world than there were 20 or 30 years ago, and democracies, by their very nature, divulge much more information than authoritarian governments do. That's not to say that they don't have secrets. I mean, the U.S. government alone keeps millions and millions of secrets every year, and we have huge bureaucracies set up to maintain those secrets. But nonetheless, in comparison to authoritarian governments, democracies divulge way more information about what they do, what their policies are, what their intentions are, and so on. There's also, of course, the spread of information and communication technology. Now, of course, there is the Internet, but it's not just the Internet. It's also camcorders and mobile phones and satellite television, which is having huge ramifications on the politics of the Middle East, for instance. Another factor would be the spread of non-governmental organizations like Amnesty International that really have as their job the ability to mobilize action by sharing information. And in order to share information, they need to collect information. Mm-hmm. They are probing and questioning and collecting information and sharing it with as big of an audience as they possibly can in order to promote their mission. There are also international organizations. When countries sign on to various international treaties and conventions, they commit to share information. But one of the ones that I talk about in the book is about the UN Convention on Conventional Arms and sharing information about arms stocks, and that's just only one example of many. And then finally, another would be the rise of the global press, not just CNN and the BBC, but Al Jazeera, Deutsche Welle, and the many 24-hour news broadcasters that are available now that are broadcasting information about news around the world in many different languages.
Mm-hmm. The let's take the last one point first to move into some of the substance of the book. Yeah, the Al Jazeera situation, and I call it a situation because it has all of these political undertones, is one that, you know, is perhaps worth exploring a little bit. The entire issue, at least when you read about it, I think from what I've seen in Western press, is the idea that this entity that does not follow the same journalistic standards as one would hope a Western news media organization would follow is going to beam what effectively is propaganda and not well-vetted journalism, and somehow in that way, by sending it into the West, the Al Jazeera network is going to influence public opinion in a way that's negative. Now, I'm characterizing a number of arguments I recognize in a rather simplistic way. But the question I want to ask with regard to Al Jazeera is whether that is the kind of transparency that you're ultimately concerned about. In other words, when we talk about transparency, are we thinking about it or should we think about it from the standpoint of what governments are willing to share or not share with the public, or is it a broader policy question about information sharing generally?
Well, there are several questions you've raised here, and I'll try and answer the last one first by saying that I'm talking about a much broader set of circumstances in the world. Information is broadly available about all kinds of things, about organizations, about different social groups, about individuals, about governments. So I'm talking about a broader phenomenon. But of course, because I'm interested in issues of governance and peace and security, I'm paying a lot of attention to governments as well. And the kind of information that governments release is very relevant to this question. Now, with respect to Al Jazeera, I don't consider myself qualified to comment on this. You know, my colleague here at GW, Mark Lynch, is really one of the leading experts on this, so you should ask him.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you're getting to is something that I've been criticized for in this book, and that is, I said in the book that transparency shouldn't be conflated with truth, and that what Al Jazeera is portraying is a particular perspective, and a lot of people agree with that perspective. I didn't feel as an analyst it was my job to assess what was true and not true, and indeed, I think it's important to recognize that one of the implications of transparency is that information spreads whether it is true or not.
Mm-hmm.
And people believe information very often that isn't true or that I personally or many others might not agree with. But that doesn't mean it doesn't have an effect on action.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the examples I started the book with is about the stories about a crime being flushed down the toilet at the Guantanamo Bay prison. Now, from all accounts, it seems like that is not actually true. But that did not stop that rumor from spreading around the world, leading to protests in many different countries, and the deaths of 17 people in Afghanistan. And, I mean, that's a tragedy. It was based on a lie, as best as anyone can see. But that didn't mean it didn't have an effect.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's trying to put an analyst like me in a position of ruling on what's true or not is not only more than I signed up to do when I went to graduate school all those years ago, but it's also missing part of the point and one of the most important points about global transparency, which is transparency spreads information and perspectives, whether they're true or false, whether everybody agrees with them or not. And one of the most interesting questions that I see is how are people interpreting information as a means of transparency, and even not just political perspectives or religious perspectives, but how are they interpreting even things that seem like very tangible, hard facts.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be happy to give you an example of what I mean.
Please.
Scientists can agree on a count of particles in a river, but if we can all agree on this, look at scientific measures about how those measurements are calculated. But that doesn't mean that two people will agree on what level of particles in a river make that river polluted or not polluted. Another example would be the ambassador tank kind of border. It really depends who the actors are, who the players are, whose tanks are they, what do we think they're going to be used for. If that's an ally, I may think the fact that an ally has more tanks on the border, I may think that makes me safer as a citizen. But if it's an enemy, even one tank is a threat. So we can count how many tanks are on the border, but people will have a very different perspective about whether they are threatening or not. So it's how people interpret the information that they have, the norms and the values that they use to interpret that information, that have huge influence in the world that we live in.
It's an interesting point that you make, and I'm willing to, certainly be put in the group of people that are the technology optimists that you mentioned. And I'm curious, from your perspective, who or what, maybe put another way, what values or what kind of beliefs about transparency do you see as the culprits for what you argue, and we'll get into it, is perhaps a too rosy view of the benefits of transparency? What are the roots of that belief structure?
Well, I think it comes from just looking at one side of the equation. I think it comes from assuming that when we lift the veil of ignorance, when we lift the confusion, that we're going to see tolerance and not hatred, that we're going to see common interests instead of conflicting interests. And I think it stems from the desire that indeed what we're going to see. And also in rhetoric, you hear very often that conflict is caused by misunderstanding. Well, that is true in some cases, but in other cases, what you understand each other all too well, and you just don't happen to agree. So I think that one of the things that transparency does is not only eliminate areas where we have common cause with others, but also where we have very plain and fundamental disagreements.
Hmm. The nature of transparency itself is one that I think we can explore a little bit here as well. And I think you got into it by mentioning criticism that your argument has received. And I guess I'll throw this question out there as well. The book makes, I think, a very compelling case for being cautious about transparency. And indeed, you've identified a few very good reasons for why we should be careful. But you also very clearly state that you're not opposed to transparency, and I think that that's a very fair reading of the book. How would you respond to critics who would say that you've made the case for less transparency as a general matter and not more?
Well, you may have guessed that I was actually concerned that people would draw the conclusion
right.
from my book.
Right.
Both the introduction and the conclusion, I think very strongly,
yes.
strongly as I possibly could, that I think that transparency is a fact. We need to live with it. We need to take advantage of the benefits provided while guarding against its risks. But also, I wanted to make very, very clear that I think that secrecy is a very bad idea for two reasons. One, I think it leads to bad government. It makes government cover up in the state. It divorces citizens from their ability to have input into the process. to protect people from criticism and therefore allows them to pursue foolhardy policies. And I also think it's morally wrong. I think citizens have a right to know where their tax dollars are going. I think when citizens are asked to put their lives on the line in combat, that they have a right to know what's happening. And so for both moral and very practical reasons of good governance, I think secrecy is a bad policy. What I'm really trying to do in this book is just make people aware that there are good sides of transparency and bad sides of transparency, like most things in the world. There are very few things in the world that are uniformly good. But by understanding the negative implications of transparency, my hope was that we could have better means to cope with them and not be surprised.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I'll say that I think you do make that point very clear. But sandwiched in the book, as you pointed out, are a lot of arguments for caution, and I think that cautionary note, I suspect, would surprise many people, and certainly from the perspective of a technologist, that's something that was particularly interesting to me. Before we get to the technology issues, and I think we'll do that after the break, one question that arises. Especially given, the fact that we're in an election season here in the United States, is apathy amongst the public. There's always been this question of what good is transparency if people really don't care or don't take the time to learn about what's going on around them. What's your view on the issue of public apathy?
Well, I think that we're actually seeing maybe a little bit less public apathy this time around. A lot of the research that when people are relatively satisfied with how their lives are going, that sometimes apathy, not that it's a good thing, but it's also symptomatic of people not feeling that they have a huge stake in the process, and that can be for negative reasons because they feel disenfranchised, but it can also be because it doesn't seem very salient to them. They feel like their lives are generally going pretty well and they have other things to do with their time. I think the turnout in some of the primaries so far has actually been higher. I think we're seeing a higher turnout. Certainly that was pivotal to Barack Obama's victory in Iowa and his ability to turn out a vote there. I think a lot of that has to do with the information revolution, the ability to engage young people on the internet, watch speeches online, and YouTube, and all of these other media that need for the people who are interested and engaged in the election. I think there are more tools than ever to be really involved.
And I think the nature of transparency in that context is something, and the technological aspects of it in particular, is something that we will pick up after a minute or so. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. Dave Levine, discussion with Professor Kristen Lord, author of the book, The Perils and Promise of Global Transparency. At this time in the show, and this tradition does continue this quarter, this is the time when I ask you for money, not from me, but in fact for KZSU. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford that relies on donations from listeners to maintain its diverse programming. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to the webpage for KZSU at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of what you do, I do hope you keep listening to KZSU as well as Hearsay Culture. And we will jump right back in our new format, which, by the way, is a good time to mention. Previously, when I was doing the show at KZSU, I tended to work more music in for logistical, but also, I think, for substantive reasons. I decided to limit the amount of music that I work in to allow a little bit more time for conversation with guests. So as those of you who are pay attention to the show may notice, I'm going directly from the bottom of the hour into a continual discussion. I think it allows for, like I said, a little bit greater discussion of the topic as well as a little more flow in the discussion. So I certainly welcome your feedback on that format change, and as always, you can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So, Kristen, let's talk about technology in particular and your views and some of the issues that surround them. You mentioned the point, and it's I think it's a certainly a phrase that jumps off the page in the book, the idea that, again, this is your quote, transparency is not synonymous with truth. And in that context, you mentioned at the top of the show your five factors that have led to the rise of global transparency. Technology is one of the factors in a general sense that you mentioned. And I'm interested to get a sense of, with respect to those factors that you've identified, where the internet and information technology that exists today, how much of an impact that has really had, given the other factors that you've mentioned.
Well, I think it depends on what part of the world you're talking about. I mean, I think it's easy to forget when you're sitting in California like you are, or in Washington, D.C. like I am, that most of the world doesn't have internet access. And so there are, in other parts of the world, the media have a much greater impact than they do here, and the internet has a much smaller effect. Radio in Africa, it has a huge effect on public opinion. In the Middle East, satellite television has a very high viewership rate, and it's very competitive. There are hundreds of satellite channels around the Middle East now. And this is where people tend to get their information instead of over the internet. Here in the United States, newspaper readership is way down, but in other parts of the world, many more people read newspapers. So I think it's important not to make too many generalizations and realize that information is something that is flowing very freely around the world, but not everybody is getting it through the same media.
The nature of technology being what it is, with respect to the issues of transparency and this idea of transparency not being synonymous with truth, how much of technology, in your view, given the limited access to technology that large portions of the world have, can ultimately impact transparency and lead to more truth getting? Or is that a pie in the sky notion right now?
Well, I mean, I think more sources of information give people more choices, and I think more choices of high quality information from very respected broadcasters like the BBC. But again, transparency is not synonymous with truth. And one of the things that I actually worry about is that the more different sources of information we have, the more people can segment themselves into very small groups and not have a common point of reference in terms of information. So no matter what your interests are, if you're you're a conservative or a skateboarder or a pair of twins or a train spotter, you can find other people around the world who share your views. You, if you're an insurgent, if you're someone who wants to join Al-Qaeda, you can find people to surround yourself with whose experience on some dimension is the same as yours. And I think what we're going to see in the world is more and more of that happening, and what will happen to society and what will happen to our common norms and values when we don't have that much of a public sphere anymore where we're all interacting with each other. That hasn't happened yet. Maybe it won't happen, but I do see it as being a risk. The more we have different sources of information and ways to communicate.
Yeah, this echo chamber issue is obviously clearly a very real one, especially where you see blog postings where the same group of people are making the same comments and talking to each other. And it does raise another issue with regard to transparency that I want to explore a little bit, which is a point that you make in your book, the difference being between voluntary and involuntary transparency on the part of any entity, government or otherwise. What do you see as the significant policy implications of viewing transparency or allowing transparency on a voluntary level versus the involuntary or compulsion or compulsed level of transparency that we often see with respect to governments revealing information?
Well, I should probably start by explaining why I made that distinction mm-hmm. in the first place. I mean, there are many things that I personally have read, books by people like Ian Sweeney, who I admire very much, to talk about how global transparency is going to lead to greater democracy, greater peace. And I would read them and I think, well, why is it that I agree with them when I hold this the other set of beliefs about the multifaceted, very complicated nature of transparency and understand that it can sometimes be dangerous? And what I decided was that really what those people are talking about is voluntary transparency. What's Libya, for instance, the side that is going to divulge information about its nuclear program and very, very different from a journalist coming in or a Human Rights Watch coming in and forcibly getting information about a government's actions against its will that it doesn't want to be public. I think the implications of that kind of information are very, very different. Sometimes governments hide through their weapons programs because they don't want others to know, because they will be threatened if they find that information out. When they divulge information voluntarily, it's usually because it's good and they want a positive result. So I think it's important to distinguish between voluntary and involuntary transparency.
Do we find, or do you find, with respect to governments, that there's a trend towards greater transparency? And if so, is that a trend that you believe is welcome? And I know I'm saying the word governments, and of course there are different kinds of governments, so perhaps I should ask you, with respect to the different kinds of governments, where the trends tend to be. I mean, clearly, if we're dealing with dictatorial regimes, transparency is limited, so perhaps we can eliminate that group and really focus on at least governments that at least have, if in no other ways through words, express the notion or the ideal that transparency is a value.
Well, I think if we look at this globally, the situation is actually very mixed. On one hand, as I said, we have more and more democracies, and democracies compared to authoritarian governments tend to be more transparent. They release more information to their citizens about what they're up to. We are, however, seeing a move to what's called a hybrid regime, like countries that maintain some religious trappings of democracy and some trappings of authoritarian governments. Russia, for instance, is moving in this direction, but many others as well. We see that in some democracies, transparency is growing. The spread of Freedom of Information Act, for instance, is a trend that has been going on for many years now, and I think that is only to the benefit of transparency. In other countries, like the United States, when there are security threats, when there are threats of terrorism, and to see a retrenchment, certainly the Bush administration has been very much criticized by people who are inclined to favor more openness in government. So I think it's a very mixed picture. And then in some areas, we see freedom of information, thanks to the Internet. But in other countries, we see a new ability to control the Internet. China has only gotten more adept at controlling the Internet the past several years. And China's actions are being mirrored throughout the Middle East, in many countries, and elsewhere in the world. China is being held up as a model for those who want to control the information environment in their country.
The standard that yeah, and this has become a cliche, certainly, but the famous phrase of John Seely Brown, that information wants to be free, and of course that was an ideal that was really blown apart in large measure through both observation of the dot-com boom and bust, but also in books like Larry Lessig's Code and others that really talked about how code can in fact be law. But it does lead us to, you know, a question with regard to transparency, I think, which is, you know, the old paradigm or the old belief that the truth will out is one that seems to be challenged by exactly what you are describing, which is government's, you know, very sophisticated ability to circumscribe and control information that's released to the public, even where we have a technology which ostensibly is unregulatable or at least is difficult to regulate. Do you think that the trend with regard to technology, in other words, that you know, you can always build a better mousetrap, will ultimately lead to the governments themselves having a more and more difficult ability to, from a practical perspective, control the information that is out there simply by virtue of the spread of technology and the ability to circumvent whatever protections are there?
I think it's actually going to be an ongoing struggle, and the struggle isn't new. Information may want to be free, and people may want information to be free, but governments and other powerful actors sometimes have an interest in not making that information free. And so the powerful find new tools to control information. People who are clever and determined find ways to get around those controls, and so it continues. The other thing to worry about is something our founding fathers worried about. Just because information is free does not mean that truth will drive out falsehood and that tolerance will drive out hatred. And it was all too familiar. A case of this is in the Rwandan genocide. Before the genocide, actually information had become freer than it had ever been before in Rwanda. But instead of leading to greater tolerance in that society, what happened was that the extremist groups had an interest in hijacking the means of communication and using it to empower themselves by saying very hateful things about the Tutsi members of their society and rallying the population on their behalf and using that as a way to give themselves ever more power and control over the information environment. So instead of spreading tolerance and letting truth drive out falsehood, it was exactly what our founding fathers worried about, which is the tyranny of the majority. When the majority don't have liberal with, in the traditional sense, thoughts, that's why we need to have legal protections in order to ensure that minority voices are always there. And there are some very interesting models, for instance, the United Nations intervention in Cambodia during the first elections there, where instead of an information free-for-all, where they feared the outcome could come closer to Rwanda, they just have exactly that model in mind or anything that's horrific. But they had a very structured environment where the different groups had a right and a platform to express their views, and then hoping that the people would make the right choice. If they were, the information was very carefully presented and the information was very carefully balanced so that the population would make views that were ultimately to the benefit of all.
And you know, the pushback on this point, because I think it's a very interesting one, and frankly, I think it's one that needs to be discussed and really isn't. So to push back on it, don't many of the conclusions that you're reaching rely on the belief that governments and entities that simply want to control the release of information, NGOs or otherwise, will be able to do so? In other words, could you, and perhaps this is pie in the sky and certainly hypothetical, but could you envision a situation, you know, down the road, and I won't ask you when because we really don't know, but could you envision a situation where technology ultimately becomes so malleable that there is no effective way for governments or others to control the flow of information, thus rendering a lot of the concerns about transparency that realistically exist today a nullity? Or am I being too optimistic about what we can reasonably expect from human beings and from operations?
I suggest that maybe you're being too optimistic.
Fair enough.
These are exactly the arguments that were made about the internet. You know, if you think you can control the internet, you're probably smoking pot. I never contemplated.
Right.
Trying to control the internet is like nailing Jell-O to the wall, like Bill Clinton, and so on and so forth. You know, I could quote you 100 of these views, but what happens is that
you quoted a few good ones right there.
Organizations with resources at their disposal find their own ways to use technology to control information. But then what I see as being the hopeful trend is that people who are clever and determined find ways around it. And that's exactly what we're seeing now in places like China, where the government finds ever new ways to control information, especially over the internet, and then although also increasingly texting on mobile phones too. But then innovative people find ways to use proxy servers and various other techniques in order to evade the controls. And to me, when I look back to my lifetime, that seems to be the trend, where it was a constant rash effect and a constant struggle, and sometimes one side seems to win over the other.
It leads us to, I think, obviously, what is a major focus of your book, and one that you know, we definitely should discuss, which is the national security climate that we're in. You talk about in the book about what you call the virtuous cycles of security and cooperation through transparency. And I guess I'll ask you, for the benefit of listeners, what that means and whether the benefits that you describe in the book with respect to war making and the initiation of wars is the ultimate trump card, if you will, for saying that we clearly want to see the trend towards transparency increase.
Well, I do think that transparency can fuel these virtuous or cycles of security or insecurity, if you will, less virtuous cycles. And when I talk about virtuous cycles, what I mean is that if countries make positive gestures or peaceful gestures towards others, that. That because the benefits become visible to all, it's a model to emulate, and as others emulate and are successful, it's widely known, and so on and so forth. That is reciprocated, and there's a positive cycle. Now, unfortunately, that can also go in the other direction. There are vicious cycles as well. If there are belligerent words or deeds on behalf of one nation that are widely seen in another, there's a reaction to that, which is usually belligerent in word and deed, and then the cycle continues. It's actually not a new phenomenon at all. One of the early cases I had looked at was something called the Peshitta crisis, where France and Britain were locked in a standoff in the Nile Valley in Egypt, and both countries actually didn't want to go to war. They were trying to avoid it in diplomatic back rooms, but when the press and the parliaments on both sides got hold of it, they were stoking the flames of nationalism and saying, the only answer worthy of France, no, Britain, we will not back down, and so on. And as this was picked up in the British press, there was a lot of pressure from parliament and the press for Britain to take a very strong response. So the cycle went. And in that particular case, it was only backroom diplomacy that stopped these two countries who didn't want to go to war from, in fact, coming to blows in Egypt. So I think we like to think about these being very new phenomena, the impact of the information revolution as being something that's only happened in the last 20 years, but it's actually not the case. It's a long-standing challenge that the governments and societies have had to face.
Yeah, it's you make a fair point there as well, because certainly we want to believe that everything is new, and certainly in the technology world, I've had plenty of conversations with people that have been around technology far longer than me, and they say, you know, they constantly remark, oh, you know, this problem that you guys are discussing, we talked about that at DEC in 1975. And here's a solution that we came up with. And I do think we have a tendency to believe that everything's new and we have to deal with it for the first time. I do want to discuss, obviously you have policy prescriptions in your book and they're interesting ones. And I want to probe them a little bit by noting you mention you have a table 6.1 on page 130 of the paperback version of the book where you describe diplomacy in the age of transparency, the rules of engagement. And rule number one is assume that whatever you say and do will become public everywhere. And you go down this list. Perhaps you could describe the list and how you came to ultimately determine what these rules should be.
Well, I think that I just finished the book, and then I said, well, what does this mean for policymakers?
Right.
It means that you have to cope with this new world, and you have to realize that when your actions and your values don't measure up, that people are going to notice. And I think that's only become more clear since I wrote the book. When you look at us holding, the U.S. holding prisoners in Guantanamo in alleged violation of international conventions, when you look at the Abu Ghraib prison crisis, which was happening when I wrote the book and had a big influence on me, when that becomes visible, that has a very damaging and broad effect on the ability of the United States to conduct its policy. That's widely evident in a world of transparency. It becomes very important to talk to public, and not just the elite. This is how I personally became interested in public diplomacy. When a lot of the world of those democracy or in authoritarian governments that are increasingly interested or have to be interested in what their own public has to say, when those publics are well informed about foreign policy and what their own governments are up to, then it means that the U.S. government can't talk to a bunch of diplomats and salons and think that that's the way it's going to achieve its objectives. I mean, unfortunately, we've seen some cases in the United States where we've even had agreements from the government in Turkey. Before the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the government was willing to basically let us use Turkey as the platform for the invasion of Iraq, but the public said absolutely not. They were furious. They were outraged, and the government had to go back on that. We see that no matter what we want to do, whether it's trying to convince more countries to come and fight alongside us in Afghanistan against insurgents there, we need to convince the public, not just government. Whether we want to place missile systems in Europe, we have to, it's the public that are objecting to that, not so much the government.
Mm-hmm.
When we want to think about where to put a new African military command, we're going to have to talk to the public, not just the government, because otherwise we could find out had been fruitless if we didn't understand the political calculations that even our allies are having to make at home.
Given this part of your policy prescription, and certainly given the fact that in the United States we're in a primary season with respect to the presidential elections, we should explore that a little bit. Without certainly asking about specific candidates, or indeed any endorsements that you may have, I'm certainly not asking for that either. But I'm curious, to the extent that you've been able to get a sense of generally the political climate here, do you get the sense that at least with respect to the political campaigns, that the campaigns are embracing the notion that transparency is here, and that there's a challenge with respect to controlling the information that's out there? Do you have any feelings with respect to how the campaigns have addressed this issue?
I don't know that I've heard much about the issue of transparency per se. Perhaps it's almost taken as a given at this point. But what I do hear is a growing concern both among Democrats and Republicans about the role of the U.S. image in the world and how the next president is going to need to address this. This is something that's not an issue of transparency per se, but global transparency makes the image of the United States very, very important. So when people learn information about United States policies, they are looking at those policies and actions and words with a particular set of feelings about the United States. And when the United States uses a country that's worthy of respect and adheres to certain values, I think then we can expect a lot more cooperation as a nation when we go to look for help in places like Afghanistan. But to the extent that there's a knee-jerk anti-Americanism because of either our policies or our culture or other aspects of American society, it's just going to be very hard to come to agreements, even on areas where we should have common cause. And I'm not just talking about very controversial issues like Iraq, but I'm even talking about issues like climate change, like dealing with the conflict in Afghanistan, where there should be a lot of common ground. It's hard to even have a fruitful discussion when just talking to the United States political
poison
for people in other countries. That is an issue I am hearing about,
and
people in the campaign talk about very much.
And it does seem like, and certainly, again, without discussing specific candidates, but there's certainly been a discussion about, and I think the public diplomacy issue in particular, about what kind of president we want in terms of how that individual is able to present the U.S. Position to societies that have grown for various reasons hostile to the U.S. and have various preconceptions about them. And to that extent, you quote at the beginning of Chapter 6, Pervez Chima, the quote is, "In the context of international relations, transparency means that the chances of misinterpretation, whether deliberate or inadvertent, are reduced to a minimum." And, you know, with that paradigm being in place, and really to ask you the hypothetical, for our next president, whoever that individual will be, what kind of transparency policy at a meta level would you suggest in terms of what the United States should be doing as far as transparency? And I'm not asking for specific amendments to FOIA, but more from a policy perspective, a vision. What kind of vision do you think that the country should embrace right now as it faces the rise of terrorism and the likelihood of more wars and more uncertainty with respect to our position in the world, given not only terrorism but also the technology that exists?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that we can't control transparency. A lot of the factors that influence how much information is available to global public and what information is available to them, it's not under American control. And we need to be a little bit humble about our ability to have any influence at all. There's an active global media, only some of which is American, and most of which is not controlled by the U.S. government. Information on the Internet mostly is not controlled by the U.S. government. So that's the first starting point, I think, is to be quite humble about what is possible and what is not. I do think, though, that in terms of the free flow of information, one thing that we can do is that we can express our support for openness as a norm, as a value, internationally and also in our own domestic policy. Transparency means that if we want others to be open and to allow the free flow of information, then we need to do that ourselves, because hypocrisy is widely evident in this world of transparency that we live in. And that means we need to have our own active and well-functioning freedom of information laws. We need to have our own rules about disclosing information. We need to make sure that the public are seeing things like the national intelligence estimate on Iran that was recently done. That's actually not something that's typically going to be released to the public. That sort of thing is very important. And then in terms of our relations with other countries, I think it's very important that we also continue to stick by our values internationally. We need to call other governments to the table and ask them to explain why they are censoring their own people, why there isn't the free flow of information. It's very important from a political perspective, but also just because of the values that we continue to hold close.
The book is The Perils and Promise of Global Transparency, and as we wrap up the discussion here with the author, Kristen Lord of George Washington University, I would be remiss in asking you something we discussed briefly before the interview, but you have an unusual or certainly a striking photograph. I believe it's a photograph on the cover of your book, perhaps at least the paperback version that I have here. Perhaps you could describe what that picture is and its significance.
That's a great question. When I was done with the book and the publisher called me and said, okay, we're ready to go to press. Do you have any ideas for the cover of the book? I said, I know exactly what it should be. And the reason I knew exactly what it should be was I was at that time working at the State Department as a Council on Foreign Relations Fellow. I was working for the Undersecretary of Democracy for Democracy and Global Affairs. We had just come back from a trip to Egypt, and we had spent 3 hours back and forth in a van with the ambassador and his wife between Cairo and Alexandria. And along the way, we saw the slums. Very poor dwellings where very poor people lived, but they were covered in satellite dishes. And I was asking the ambassador and his wife, who was a scientist, I said, what is the implication of these people who are very poor, have no voice in their government, who feel very frustrated, who have no economic opportunity, but yet they have satellite television, they can see everything that's going on in the world, they can see how much wealth there is, they can see how much the haves have and how little the have-nots have. What does that mean for the world? And so we talked about that at great length when I was there in Egypt, and then when I came back, I knew immediately that the right cover of the book were pictures of some of the buildings, like the ones I had.
It is really a striking picture, because as I look at it, for the benefit of the listeners, you do see these apartment buildings with air conditioning units and what appear to be terraces, and then the roof is literally covered with satellite dishes and other forms of aerials. It's a remarkable photograph, and I think it's a good way to kind of sum up our discussion here. For those that are interested in learning more about this topic and this area, do you have any recommendations?
I mean, there are a lot of great books. I've tried my best in my book to cite the ones that I think are just really excellent. You can look through the bibliography and the footnotes. There's also a new book called Blacked Out about government secrecy in the United States, which I would recommend. I think you've actually interviewed the author on the program.
Yep.
And then the Federation of American Scientists has a project on secrecy. Run by Steve Aftergood, which is really superb.
He's actually also been a guest on the show. Yeah, it's good. I feel like I'm covering the topic fairly well, because by having you on with this extremely significant book, in my judgment, I've also had both of the individuals that you've mentioned on the show previously. So I feel a certain ratification on the part of experts that I'm covering this topic well.
It's a very complicated topic, but you seem to have some of the leading voices. Steve Aftergood, for instance, is fantastic.
Thank you so much, Professor Lord. The author of the book, The Perils and Promise of Global Transparency, Why the Information Revolution May Not Lead to Security or Peace. Thank you so much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've been listening to Hearsay Culture with Professor Lord, and I I think this discussion is a good way to kind of discuss briefly before we close the show some of the other guests we have coming on the show. This particular schedule is a work in progress, but I look forward to speaking to Michelle Bowens. Michelle Bowens is head of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, and we'll be talking to him about peer-to-peer technology. I'm also looking forward to speaking to Eric Davis. Eric was on the show as a guest last year, and we're going to discuss California mysticism as well as his work looking at Led Zeppelin. Now, this is about as far a stretch from hearsay culture's topics as you can imagine. The California mysticism aspect of it, however, has particular relevance to technology because part of it really looks at the landscape that exists in California that one could at least argue or extrapolate might have contributed to the development of the technology and tech sector there. We're also going to be speaking to several intellectual property law professors, including Brett Frischman from Loyola, Ned Snow from Arkansas on their work, and several other guests that I continue to schedule. As always, you can listen to Hearsay Culture in a number of ways. You can listen live on KZSU by going to either 90.1 FM in the Bay Area, or by going to kzsu.stanford.edu. You can also get the show through iTunes. The iTunes webpage is still connected with the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, where the show remains on the iTunes page there, and Stanford continues, obviously, to support Hearsay Culture, and for that I am grateful. You can get that show and that feed by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu, which is CIS's webpage. And lastly and not least, you can go to hearsayculture.com, where not only will you find all the shows, but you also find the upcoming schedules and occasionally my blog musings. Podcasting, as anyone that does it and anyone that listens can imagine, takes quite a bit of time, and so I focus on my podcast, but I do occasionally blog, and I try to use the blog not only as an outlet for my own issues, but also to make sure that listeners are aware of what's going on the show. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, thoughts, ruminations by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Suggestions for guests are always welcome, and I do take them seriously, but also improvements or things I can do better or things I'm doing well. Any feedback is much appreciated. So thank you again for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for further programming, and I look forward to talking to you next week.